let's see. You've mentioned about 18 things I want to pursue here, but I'll go for the one dear to my heart. I'm an English major too.
Oh yes.
Tell me about being an English major.
Well, I was known as the Phantom English major, which was not good. I don't remember how I picked English. And in retrospect, there were only three or four disciplines that had comps in those days, and English was one of them. And I don't know how many times toward the end of my 4 years I thought back what an idiot I had been to get myself into this terrible mess. It was a fascinating department. I think Sev Duval, in many respects, is my most memorable character. I was just awestruck by him. George Ray was there. I studied Shakespeare under Ray, and became he was pretty young when I started, and so I think the people in my class had kind of an affinity to him just based on age. And it turned out after when I joined White and Case in 1987, his daughter Jenny was the recruitment director in New York for White and Case. And that was also about the time that I became involved, seriously involved again in alumni matters, and my son went off a few years after. So we struck up quite a renewal relationship around Jenny. For God's sake, I can't think of his name. The English professor of all English professors.
Sid Cowling.
Sid Cowling was there, and I have my own Cowling story.
Please.
Well, it's sort of a personal thing. As I said, I flunked out my freshman year of undergraduate and had to apply for reinstatement, which fortunately Eddie Atwood was nice enough to let me back in. And there was a tradition in those days that, at least we thought there was a tradition, that the number one graduate in the law class, if they had an A average, was admitted to Phi Beta Kappa. And I think, at least I thought for a long time, that that was really the only place in the United States where a graduate student could get into Phi Beta Kappa, which is basically an undergraduate thing. And I did finish number one in my law class, and I mentioned earlier that Rob and I finished like 3/1000ths of a point apart, I think, and mine was like 4.001 and his was 3.99 whatever 8, so I was just over an A average. And the story got back to me sometime thereafter, not long after all this happened. I was not invited to join Phi Beta Kappa. That when my name came up, and Sid Cowling was then the president or whatever of Phi Beta, he ran the chapter, that he asked somebody if that was the same Walker that had been an English major several years earlier, and they confirmed that it was, and he said, "Not on my life." For all the right reasons. Certainly during my undergraduate years, I was the antithesis of a Phi Beta Kappa student. At the time, I was very angry about that, but I got over it pretty quickly. I realized about 3 years later that all that stuff only helped get you your first job, and then nobody really cared about it anymore, unless you went back into academia. But he was there. Jim Boatwright, who some years later died in Key West, was on the faculty. My most memorable, and I don't really remember why, was Sev Duval. I took a course from him, I think my first semester, well, it didn't matter what semester, I guess, my junior year, on Southern novels. And he is just such a, he's almost a caricature to me of a Southern professor. The accent, his look, he clearly, as much as any professor I ever remember having, was in love with his subject. He loved everything about what he was doing, And it just, it glowed through him how happy he was doing what he was doing. And it was kind of enchanting. Actually, that course might have been my sophomore year, because he was one of the reasons I decided to major in English. He made a huge impression on me. Sid Cowling was always just sort of a mystery to all of us. He was so smart. And I think we were, in a different way, not as warm a way as with Sev Duval, but I think all of us were in awe of Cowling. He obviously was so incredibly intelligent. And so much that he said, we didn't really understand. Not that he wasn't a great professor, it's just when he'd get off on some of the things that you kind of wondered where he was. They were just a very, very impressive group of people. Perhaps more so than, at least to me, than any other discipline I met there. I was never very good at science, so I never got too into the science group, other than Jim Starling, who was just a favorite of everybody's. Well, Mr. Walker, consult your friend in the corner. He kept a dictionary in the room, and that was your friend in the corner. He didn't know a word. The English professors were all very conventionally dressed. They were a great group. And other than the comps, it was a great experience.
Did Sev Duval bring his dog to class?
You know, I don't remember. He was known for his dog in more recent years. I know from my son and from the alumni magazine. I don't remember that he had a dog then. If he did, it's gone to me now.
I just think that's so charming.
Yeah.
I see him going off into his office.
And it's such a beautiful dog. That he and his dog have become, I think, joined to the hip somehow. I mean, in everybody's mind as well as in fact.
I think it's very funny that the head of security has a puppy.
Well, there were a lot of kids that had dogs at WNL, and I have a son who's a junior at Swanee now, and it's sort of the norm at Swanee. There are hundreds of dogs running around the Swanee campus during class time. Well, their masters are in class, there are dogs everywhere. And that can only happen at places like WNL and Swanee. Mm-hmm.
Were there any particular places you hung out?
Oh, yeah. Doc's Corner Grill, which is a catty corner from the post office. I guess that's still the main post office. The College Inn, I guess, was the biggest sort of official hangout, which is now the bakery, I guess, and it's in that little stretch. I'm not sure what used to be the CI. The Central Lunch, which was, what was the guy's name? He used to run the Central Lunch. He had a glass eye, and he was a real strange character. And there was another place right across, next to the CI and across from the Central, I can't remember what it was called, which had the best pool table and pinball machines in town. So that, for the people that like to do that, that was a hangout.
Was that Jabba's?
No.
I think Jabba's was gone by the time you got there.
Yeah, that was gone. And then, in a sense, I guess, the Lyric Theater and the State Theater were kind of hangouts. There wasn't a whole lot to do in Lexington in those days, other than Fraternity House. And so movies were, you know, they were usually eighth run movies, but they were pretty popular. In fact,
they're still eighth run movies. Yeah,
one of the things to do in those days was called the double flick. I think the movies were at 7 and 9, so you'd go to the 7 at one, and then you get out and run to the 9 at the other. But the most popular spot, I guess, all in all, was the restaurant bar kind of thing, was the CI, which was upstairs, was pizza, where they serve pizzas and spaghetti, and I guess sort of a typical Italian kind of place, college Italian kind of place. Downstairs wasn't there, it wasn't open my freshman year. By the time I left law school, there was a big downstairs, it was a bar, kind of fancy bar with more eating. And then upstairs was the VMI room. Every place had a VMI room. At Doc's, the VMI room was a back room at the Quid, the Liquid Lunch. I can't remember where it was. I guess it must have been upstairs somewhere. But every place had a separate VMI room.
What do you mean a VMI room?
Well, they couldn't take off their blouse, and they couldn't drink beer in public. I don't think they could drink beer anywhere, but they did, and the schools all knew they did, and they all knew they did, and but they just didn't do it in where you could see them through a window. So they would have a room at each of these places where they would go with their dates or just together. They'd take off, or at least unzip or take off their tunic, whatever it is, and get comfortable, and they would drink beer and whatever, party. But because they couldn't do it out in polite company, they always had to have a back room or an upstairs or downstairs room where they could do it. Which always seemed kind of crazy, because everybody, I mean, as I say, the schools all knew they were there. You'd have members of the faculty out in the main room while the cadets were back wherever they were doing their thing. But it's just the way life was.
I grew up in Annapolis. I know the scene very well.
What an ugly, I was saying to somebody, as a matter of fact, coming in the office this morning, I've got that W&L bumper sticker on my car, DUBY.
Me too.
And
me too, I love
people it. Stop me constantly. What in the world is that? In fact, I was at church 6 or 8 months ago, and a lady in our parish, we were in the parking lot leaving at the same time, came over to me and she said, I've been meaning to ask you this. I see that thing every week. It's driving me nuts. What in the world does it mean? Of course, people sort of struggle to pronounce it. And I said, it's my alma mater. And she said, what? I said, W&L, Washington Lee. And she turned beet red and she said, oh my God, I'm so embarrassed. I said, why? She said, I went to Mary Baldwin. It never occurred to me.
Well, he's a good Mary Baldwin girl.
Yeah.
Here she blushed.
Right.
Great.
So in any event, it's...
One of my favorite interviews that I did was with Charlie McDowell Jr.
I can imagine.
And we had a big discussion about how you spell W&L. Because he never said Washington and Lee. He always just said W&L. So when I saw that bumper sticker, I bought one for me and for him and sent one.
Oh, I think it's great. I think it's absolutely great. And whoever thought it up was a genius.
I think so, too. I took it home, and my husband and I started trying to figure out how you do UVA and all the others and trying to figure out.
I think schools are jealous that they can't do it.
There's probably an industry coming up here. Fancy dress.
Ah, yes, fancy dress. I think a bigger deal in those days than it is today.
Was this dining hall?
Yeah.
When you
I think all 7 years. I don't think it was ever in the gym. I don't remember that it was ever in the gym. Usually, there'd be a big concert for a fancy dress weekend, and that was usually in the gym. Although one time, for some reason, we had it in the VMI field house. I don't remember what that was. Maybe the dance was in the gym. But all the recollections I have of fancy dress were that they were in Evans, which was much nicer than the gym. But those are the only two places in town it could have been that would have held it. It was a big deal. It was after exams. We weren't on the trimester system then, so we went home for Christmas and we had to go back and take exams. And then the big blowout was fancy dress, and it was famous, like Dartmouth Winter Carnival or a handful of others. It was a famous weekend, and we were probably as much caught up in its fame as in the reality of it in those days. The women came from all over. That was one of the weekends. The four big weekends were openings, fancy dress, springs, and finals. And those are the weekends if you had a hometown honey or a girl hundreds of miles away. That was the one of the weekends she would come down. And it sort of started Thursday and went through Sunday. It was always a big orchestra, at least a big orchestra. And once or twice we had two bands, although I think that was more popular after I'd left than before. Because when I was, particularly when I was an undergraduate, although rock and roll was the thing, people still knew how to dance enough when they got to college that you could have just a big swing orchestra and nothing more, and people could still dance to it. Where today, if you have a big swing orchestra and nothing else, half the kids can't dance because they don't know how. And the dance itself was a big deal, but it was more the weekend than the dance itself. The dance itself was, at that point, no longer a costume ball. That was already pretty much gone. The stories I've heard, which I'm sure you've heard more than I, were that 10 years before I got there, maybe even 5 years before I got there, you would go be sized somewhere, but you never knew what you were going to be until you went to pick up your costume, you and your date's costume. But the time, I never wore a costume to fancy dress. I went every year. I know I went every year as an undergraduate. I probably went every year as a law student, and I just wore white tie and tails. I think that committee members, at least, probably came in some kind of thematic costume, Old South or whatever it might have been. I don't recall that there was ever a theme ball. And I don't recall many people wearing costumes. I think of it as just a black tie, a big, fancy black tie dinner dance, a dance. But then there'd be, the fraternity houses had parties every night, a fancy dress. Usually with a big band, or not a bit necessarily big, but a well-known band, the Thornton Sisters or the Hot Nuts were popular then. There was a group around the South called the 13 Screaming Niggers, which was, I guess because of the name, it was funnier than the band itself, but they were popular.
Who were the Hot Nuts?
You don't know the Hot Nuts?
I do, but I want you to tell me about them.
They still play at Washington Lee.
I know, but you tell me.
They were a group, Doug Clark and the Hot Nuts, out of Chapel Hill. And they still drive, I swear it's still the same van they show up in, who, in an era of, I suppose, still relative propriety, popularized what then seemed terribly dirty, off-color lyrics. By today's standards, what we see on television every night, it was really pretty stupid. But they were very popular. And they were almost impossible to get back in those days because it was the height of their records were selling nationally and they were sort of sweeping the nation. So they're very difficult to get. But they played once in a while back then. I think they play more at W&L today than they did then. And Doug Clark, by God, is still leading the group.
Who else? What other big entertainers came in?
Ian and Sylvia, because my era included that one or two years of folk music. I remember Ian and Sylvia's concert. Probably to this day, the best concert I ever heard was the Letterman, who did a concert either my junior or senior year. No. My freshman or sophomore year, because I was not there with my wife and I didn't date anybody else after we met my junior year. A phenomenal concert. Dionne Warwick did one of the concerts when I was there and she was very popular. Ian and Sylvia are memorable because it was fancy dress. There had been a terrible snowstorm and this had to be my sophomore year, and they couldn't get over the mountain. They were coming from the Roanoke Airport, Roanoke or D.C., I don't remember which, and everybody was in their seats. Somebody did something for an hour, and they kept coming to the microphone and announcing that they just got the phone call and they were making their way there, and they ended up walking into this with their band and setting up while everybody sat there, and they started sort of singing one at a time. Somebody would just, when they got tuned up, they'd play something while everybody else got ready. It was just a neat, kind of a neat experience, a neat concert because of the way it all came about. And that was the weekend that Central Virginia got absolutely snowed in. It was the worst, the heaviest snowfall to that date that in recorded history, supposedly. And the entire eastern part of the state was just absolutely shut down. This happened, started, I think, Friday, and it sort of went straight through Sunday. By Sunday, all the roads were closed. You couldn't get out of Rockbridge County, much less anywhere else. And I had a date with my hometown honey, who had to be back at Jackson, which was then the women's section of Tufts, for registration Monday morning or Monday sometime. And we ended up, along with one of my roommates, or fraternity brothers, later one of my roommates, who had a date with a girl from Dickinson College, I think, who had to get back. We ended up getting in my Volkswagen and driving to D.C., which in those days was about a 3.5-hour drive. It took 7 hours to get there. When we got there, National was still closed. And we ended up having to stay in a hotel, which was impossible to find because everything was full in Alexandria, I guess, that night. And they finally got out sometime the next day. Incredible snowstorm. Some of the girls from Sweetbriar and Hollins were still at Washington Lee on a Wednesday, the following Wednesday, because they couldn't get back, or used it as an excuse not to go back. But Fancy Dress was, I have very warm memories of Fancy Dress, as I said earlier, I think as much probably because of what it was as the particular weekend. But we always had a good time.
One of the other uniquely Washington Lee things is the mock convention. Mm-hmm. Did you get involved with that?
No. In fact, I didn't go to the convention, which was 1968, my senior year. I never got involved in it, and I didn't go. I might have been out of town the weekend of the convention itself, but I had, and I don't really remember why. I just, nobody in my fraternity was involved with it, which is probably a big part of it.
One of the things that I was intrigued by, as I've been looking for photographs for the book, was that Nixon was on campus that year for the ODK Founders Day talk. Did you go to that?
No. I was tapped for ODK in law school, but I was nowhere near ODK as an undergraduate. I remember that Claude Kirk was the, who was then the governor of Florida, was the keynote speaker at that 68 convention. I don't remember Nixon being there.
No, he didn't come from mock convention.
No, I understand, but yeah, I don't remember that.
I thought I was looking at mock convention, and I said, wait a minute, I thought the candidates weren't allowed to come to mock convention, and then I later figured out from Michaelis that he was there for Founders.
Which would have been before, mm-hmm. Yeah, because that the Founders Day was normally in February, I think.
January 19th.
Yeah.
Robert E. Lee's birthday.
Oh, that would make sense, yes.
Were there any other speakers that you remember from your time? I know Barry Goldwater was there when you were there.
Yeah. Who was the fellow that wrote All the King's Men? Robert Penn Warren. I remember hearing him speak. And I remember being very impressed by him. He read his poetry and spoke. And I was I loved All the King's Men. I loved that book. Other speakers while I was there. I remember some speakers from law school. I don't remember any other in particular speakers that were there when I was an undergraduate.
Let's go on to law school.
We were in Tucker Hall,
right?
We were in Tucker Hall. We were... Roy was sort of designing the law school while we were there, but we were not the last class in Tucker Hall, but we were one of the last because there were probably three more after we left. And to this day, it seems a tragedy to me that they moved the law school off of the hill. It's clear to me, although I'm assured by people like Lash, LaRue, and Joe Ulrich, who were friends of mine, Uncas McThenia, they say I'm romanticizing, that it really wasn't the way I remember it, But and part of my romanticism probably is, again, the fact that I was a seven-year man. So I had ties to the undergraduate school that most law students didn't. But with all of that, it seems to me that the law school was much more a part of the university than it is today. It's very clear to me today, talking to both college students and law students, that you can go to 3 years of law school there and never have any thought that you're a part of that thing up on the hill. You're just a part of the law school.
It sure seems that way.
And that's very sad. We had the white lawn chairs in those days, which were lined up against the front wall of Tucker Hall, and then in the spring they'd be sort of be carried out into the lawn, and only law students could sit in them. And law students were very much, they weren't a role model. I don't think that'd be a fair way to put it. But all the undergraduate students looked, you were aware that they were there. You were conscious that these older men, more responsible, more mature people were around. And I think that it, I don't suppose I could define it, but I think to this day it had a measurably positive impact on life of the university. And it was a better experience for the law students that experienced the university than what they get today. Would you bring me a cup of coffee? You want some?
Sure. Sorry, I didn't know you were here.
I still think if they could find a way to move at least half of the classes or something on the hill so that the law students would have a meaningful presence on the hill, it would be much better for the law students and probably better for the college. It's a shame.
Yeah, it's very clear to me that there's a big difference whether people realize it or not.
I was there, as I said, 68 was, I think Neli was in 68, I think that's right. I had taken ROTC largely because we had a guaranteed deferment for law school and I didn't want to go to Vietnam. I would have if I'd had to, obviously, but I didn't want to. So by going to law school, we were guaranteed 3 years and it worked for me. The war ended basically my beginning of my senior year in law school and I ended up going in for 89 days of active duty and was then discharged from active duty anyway. And so we had a huge number of vets that were coming back. I had in my class probably as many as 10 VMI grads, which was very unusual in those days. But these were guys that were coming back, they had the GI Bill, although it wasn't that big a deal in those days by then. But they knew Washington Lee because they had spent 4 years in Lexington. And we had a great time in law school. I was married. I got married at the end of June, graduating from the college. I had a job lined up. I told you earlier I was working at the College Town Shop, and Red Patton, who was then running the College Town Shop, one of my dear, dear friends, had agreed to let me work that summer. So we got married, took our honeymoon, raced back to Lexington. We had a we had an apartment at Bean's Bottom, which was a great coup. Bill Bean was a good friend of Red's, and when we told Red we were going to get married and come back, he set me up with Bill Bean, who just happened to have, the day we went to see him, had received word from whoever was living in what became our apartment that they were leaving. And he gave us the apartment. And those were the most sought-after places, literally the most sought-after places out there, unattainable for the most part by undergrads. He only rented to law students and faculty. But we had a magnificent apartment out there. We had three bedrooms, one bath, on the second floor of the second building from the bridge. We were unfortunately there for the great flood of 1969.
I think you were on the second floor.
Yeah, we had 5 feet of water on the second floor.
Oh my God.
We had gotten back from we'd moved into the apartment. All of our wedding presents were most of our wedding presents that we weren't using and we didn't use a lot were in barrels, still packed, professionally packed. We must have had 10 barrels of china and silver and crap that were stored in the extra bedroom and in the closets and whatnot in there, all of which ended up just dissolving in the water. That night, Bill came down. Mickey Phillips lived underneath us. Now, Mickey was in the building next to us on the ground floor. Who was the university photographer forever. I'm sure you must have come across his name.
No, Mickey. No,
Mickey what? Phillips. He was the, he was single. He was emotionally more student than non-student. I don't think he had an official faculty role in terms of teaching anything, although he might have taught photography, but he was the official, what's the guy's name now, Heinle?
Pat Heinle.
He was the Pat Heinle of his day, and he was there for 10 or 12 years.
Well, I must have lots of his photographs.
Oh, you've got to have hundreds of them.
I've never seen his name. He didn't use a rubber stamp on the back of him.
Mickey lived downstairs next to us.
Do you know where he is today?
No. I have no idea. Although I would...
Had he graduated? So did he graduate?
I think he was a W&L grad. He must have been. I don't know that for a fact.
No, but I know. Well, that's...
Fran and Mickey were buddies. If you get back to Fran, he'll probably know where Mickey is. Immediately below us was actually a lawyer who works right across the street, who was not a W&L grad. How he and I ended up in the same town, I'll never understand. And the other name I remember in our building was Bill. He was a swimming coach there for years. Bill Stearns, who I understand is still in Lexington and owns half the town. We had been, my wife and I were counselors at a girls' camp in northern Michigan the summer between my freshman and sophomore year. We had just gotten back into town that day. We came back early for moot court, which was a sort of an honor and an activity in the law school. And Robin Lene Hartman, who I mentioned earlier, my best friend, they had, I don't know where they'd spent the summer, but they'd been back for 4 or 5 days, and they were living in town, actually right near B. Copper, B. Copper's house in an apartment, a garage apartment. And with their son, they drove out that night because we'd just gotten in and we had dinner. And we later concluded that Rob and Lene were probably the last car to get back in, I don't know what the official name of the road was, we always called the Goshen Road, that got back in that night. And Rob said that when he got down by the old mill there, the water was about up to his door, but he'd gotten down to that last flat part, and he'd gotten far enough into it that he couldn't go back and just had to keep going forward. The water was literally rising. You could see it at that point. But they got through and we still weren't taking this very seriously. I mean, we had not been there for the 4 or 5 days of rain that led up to it, but it was just unthinkable that what ultimately happened could happen. Bill came down about, I don't know, 1 o'clock in the morning maybe, and knocked on our door and woke us up. We had gotten to sleep, so we weren't too worried about it. And the house next to us, which was the first one, the most downstream house, was starting to shake real badly. And they were worried the houses were gonna go. And there were big trees, trucks, cars. We had a two-story house float by us ultimately that night. I mean, big debris was starting to come down. And at that point, he wasn't so worried about our safety as just saying, you know, wake up, be aware, sort of keep an eye on it. An hour or so later, when it first became clear that by that time the ones downstairs were totally underwater, and they weren't even back. The guys that lived downstairs, Mickey was there because he lived there full time, but the students down below us, who were classmates of mine, weren't even back in town. They didn't have anything, so it didn't really matter. So sometime in the night when it became clear that we might get some water in the apartment, the first thing we did is we took drawers, we took the stereo and whatnot, and put it up on the beds, never thinking it could be more than, you know, a foot or 6 inches. Because the top story of those apartments are all... we're all like 2.5 feet above the driveway. I don't remember why, that's just the way they were built. eventually water came in front of the house as well as behind it. And the, when we finally stopped going in to bring stuff out, it's because enough water and debris was rushing past the front of the house, and about 2.5 feet deep, it wasn't safe to walk into the front to bring stuff out. But I put most stuff up on beds. We got finally got most of the clothes out and tossed them in the trunk of our car, and we ended up going up and spending the night at Al and Jan Orgain's house, who were also law students, and they were up higher on the hill, and they never got wet. They were actually a little higher than Bill's house, Bill's own house, which was out there. It turned out we had about 5 feet, 1 inch inside, because it was a mud line, ultimately. Amazing things happened. Our refrigerator was in a cove in the kitchen. The refrigerator had moved out of that cove, and there wasn't room to, on each side to put your hands to pull it out, and had moved partway across the kitchen. All the beds, of course, ended up floating, so they dumped everything that was on the beds. And virtually everything we owned was wet. There was nothing higher than 5 feet in that apartment. And it was a pretty devastating experience at the time. We had befriended a couple in Buena Vista who had been operating a restaurant for a couple of years in an old southern mansion over there. I don't remember the name of it. It was a great restaurant. The guy had sort of a secret recipe for steak. It was one of these places you'd take a bottle, you'd go in and sit in the living room, and they'd come in and take your bottle and mix you drinks in a silver tray, and then take you in the dining room. And very popular place. And
it sounded like Buena Vista.
No, it didn't. And we somehow had become, these people had befriended us, they ended up, they had bought, by the time this all happened, they had bought the old, it's now a retirement home. It was then called the, what in the Southern
Mayflower?
Inn? Yeah, the Mayflower, up there on Main Street. And they gave us a room in the Mayflower, and we were in that room probably for 10 days. When they first went into our apartment, the first thing it is when to get the snakes out, because there were snakes everywhere. And then they literally went in with hoses just to get the mud out, hoses and shovels. But we ended up saving virtually everything, the beds. We slept on that bed until 4 years ago. We still have a couple of lamps that were in it. That's about all we still have left. We kept the lamps because they still had a little mud on them. We never wanted to forget the experience. And we took the TV and the stereo over to some place in Buena Vista that worked on them, and the clothes, what we hadn't gotten out, we took to a cleaner. And, you know, a little bit at a time, it all came back together. This all happened 3 or 4 weeks before I went back to school, because we had to be back early for this moot court thing. We had a lot of research to do. And Laura was teaching at Rockbridge County High School. In fact, that was the year after she was Rockbridge Teacher of the Year. And so she had a couple of weeks before she had to get back to work, and we managed to, you know, get cleaned up and get back in. I think we were back in before classes actually started. It was something I would not want to do again.
Amazing.
It was literally the 100-year flood. I think that was 1969,
yes.
And I think it was either 1868 or 1870. Had been the last time that there was any record of water being that high out there. And it's happened since, is the amazing
it's
thing.
Happened three times.
Yeah.
Not last year, but the year before.
Christopher, my son, who graduated 2 years ago, lived in a road that I only remember knowing was there when I was in school, on the opposite side of the river from Bean's Bottom. Right, well, as you go across the viaduct, if you go out to East Lexington, before you go across the bridge, there's a little road that runs down. There's a now a, not a Pantry Pride, there's some kind of a little 7-Eleven kind of place there. And a little road that goes down behind it on
yes.
that side of the river.
Yes, there's a little park there.
And he lived in an apartment on that road his about 2 years when he was there, second, third year, I guess. And he lived there one of the years of the flood. One of the floods, and they had about 4 feet of water in their place. So it's amazing. We would never live on a river again.
That happened twice in 1 week.
Yeah.
That, well, I guess it must have been when your son was there.
And
oh,
we
no,
can.
That was in the summertime. Was he there in the summertime?
No. He was.
He must have been there when. Well, that was a year ago in January.
Oh, this was. His flood would have been at least 5 years ago.
Oh, I don't know about that one. I don't know about that one. But this last Founders Day, a year ago Founders Day, it took me 4 hours to get into work. And when I arrived, I said, I've never been through hell and high water before.
Yeah.
But it took us, we had to go round and round and round and
it
round
was,
to
it
find
was
a
ugly.
Road that we could get through.
It was ugly. Brought out the best in people. I will say that we had no shortage of help, and people drove out along the river and stopped and got out of their cars and rolled up their sleeves and helped people clean up. And but it was very traumatic at the time.
Yeah, it's quite something to see. Our area where we live was the area that was most devastated a year and a half ago.
Are you all, where are you in the?
Up in Walker's Creek, north of Goshen.
Mm-hmm.
And we were the most, our area was the most devastated in that flood.
The power of we were here for Andrew. We were in our house for Andrew. But I was not as impressed by Andrew as I was by that river. Part of it, I guess, is in a thing like Hurricane Andrew, you're ultimately in the worst of the storm. You're in the middle of a house. We were under mattresses. And thought the roof was coming off. So we weren't out experiencing it. You can stand next to that river in the middle of that flood and stand there 2 feet away from the water, perfectly safe, and watch it happen. And after we finished getting stuff out that night, we sat there and watched it. We saw till the point it gets 2 or 3 feet of water inside, then I was exhausted, I went to bed. But I distinctly remember standing there and watching that. I remember this two-story house going by, sort of breaking up as it went by. But it had come. There weren't any two-story houses within. I'd been pretty far upriver from there. There weren't any close by, so it had come from a distance. And they found a couple of cars down there under the bridge at East Lexington that had come from miles away.
Yeah. We had one family lost 4 cars.
The one interesting part about in those days, there was no federal flood insurance. The only thing that anybody owned that was insured was their car. And this was back before the roads were rebuilt at Bean's Bottom. It used to be the main road, you came off the bridge. In fact, the old bridge was there. You came off the bridge, had a hard right, and went right by the front door of the houses at Bean's Bottom. Since then, the road has been goes more up the hill and you swing back into Bean's Bottom. But back then, when it became clear the water was going to get that high, we must have had 15 farmers from a couple of miles up road from us all bring their trucks down and park them by the bridge.
Oh, that's weird.
These old trucks. And sure enough, a lot of them had insurance claims. Yeah, it was pretty bizarre. Because it was sort of blocking our ability to get stuff in and out at the time. But.
Oh, that's interesting. I've got a couple more questions. Can I pop in another
Sure.
Tape?